We are just coming up on 7:30, so thanks all for joining in this evening, and welcome to any new people that we have with us tonight. We welcome guests at any time at the Ottawa PCUs group. If you are interested in joining, you can find the link. I pasted it into the chat, or you can just go to the homepage on our website and click on the Join or Renew button at the top, and that'll walk you through the process. It's just $20 a year, and we have a special on now through March 31st, where if you pay your $20 rather than getting 1 year membership, you get a 2 year membership. And with that, we've got a really big agenda tonight, so I'll hand it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Thank you very much, Chris. Have you muted people?
No, I haven't, and I will right now. So as always, you will have the ability to unmute yourself. If you do so, please remute yourself after making a comment or question so we keep background noise to a minimum.
Okay, so we'll start off with, I think, a number of follow-ups from last time. First of all, income tax software, a couple of extra things came along. Studio tax now, somebody has confirmed that the current version is now available. And I think that's one that works on Windows 10. And somebody else recommended a program called Genu, G-E-N-U, which again is a Windows 10 application. So if you want income tax software for Windows 10, there's a couple of candidates for you.
And Genu Tax will run on any version of Windows from 10 on.
Okay. Yeah, some questions about last time you upgraded your phone. In the chat, basically, there was a raft of answers. I think it was Tim said his recent upgrade was done at a Bell store, and they actually moved just about everything from the old phone to the new one. Somebody does a backup to Google, and then has the new phone reload everything from the web. Different phone manufacturers have their own transfer process often, and this individual recommends taking a backup of the original before you make the switch. I think it was Harvey suggested if you have a micro SD card in your old phone, then you should move that over rather than disposing of your old phone, presumably with the micro SD card still in it. And that probably has information of yours that you would like to retain. I think Harvey too said he sold his own phone to a company called Go Resell. And there's the URL for that. I think it was Tim said he can use his old phone as a tablet. I don't know whether that's a huge phone or a tiny tablet, but certainly that is an option. There was a question about third-party PST readers for Outlook mail folders, mail files. And one of the suggestions was to use Kernel Outlook PST Viewer. And there's the URL for that third-party program. And another one called MailStore Home, it can also read PST files. And I presume those are both directly. You just open up the files that you have. Okay, a question that came in a week or two ago, and Chris has the question, and he has all the answers.
Some of the answers, anyway. Bob Walker sent in this asking if he could share his Google Calendar, and he wanted to have it so that other authorized people can look at it and make additions to it. So it's actually fairly straightforward. If I can get the controls to work. There we go. It's all in the settings. So if you want to share your calendar, you go into your calendar, and then in the left-hand pane, it has your month, and then below that, you'll have My Calendars. And you can go on, the first entry should be your personal calendar. And if you hover over it, you'll get a kebab menu, which is the three vertical dots. They'll appear, and you click on the three vertical dots. and then you get a pop-up, and then you can go to settings and sharing. And when it flips you over to that, you scroll down a little bit down the page, and you'll get to share with, and you click on that, and then you can click on add people or groups, and then enter a Gmail address. Now, this is important. It's a Gmail address you want to be dealing with, and I'll talk more about why it has to be a Gmail address rather than a Google account that you want to share with. So you type in the email address of the Gmail user you want to be able to share with, and then there we go. Then you set permissions on it. So you can have it see only, so they can just read your calendar, but they, or sorry, the free busy, but you don't get any of the details at all. Or you can see all event details, so they will be able to see complete but not edit capabilities. Or you can make changes to events, in which case they can see everything and they can edit any of the events. And then probably the most dangerous one of all, make changes and manage settings. So they could go and share your calendar with other people or things like that. So I would suggest under most circumstances, the first three are the most appropriate, and you choose what level of permission you want for each person you share with. Come on. There we go. Okay, I think I went one too far. There we go. Okay, so if you have been given permission to anything, see a calendar or edit items or whatever, you should get an email sent to you saying that this person has shared their calendar with you, and then you have a blue button there saying join shared calendar. And you click on that, and the calendar will open up, and you'll get a pop-up where it'll offer to add that person's calendar to the list. And when you do that, under other calendars, you'll end up seeing that other person's calendar, and you can toggle it on or off. And you can see it gives a color code to it. So in this case here, the calendar that was shared is in orange. So if I toggle that on, those items will show up on the on my calendar, I can see them. And if I've been given edit capabilities and so forth, I could go in and change from whatever I had to do. If I don't want to see them all the time, I can just click on the check mark there, and that'll toggle it off so you don't have it in your face all the time. So if you're giving permissions, you want to be able to revoke permissions. So to do that, you go again to your list of calendars under My Calendars, and you hover over to get the kebab menu, and you click on that, go to the settings and sharings again, and in this case, under the shared with, you go and you'll see the person or persons that you shared it with, and then you can click on the X to revoke the permissions from that if you want to. Or you can change permissions if you wanted to at that point. Now, last little bit, a couple of little bits. The when you're sharing calendars, it has to be a Gmail account that you're sharing with, and it's because of the fact that the way that they're going to access it to be able to do full editing and things like that, they have to do it through Google Calendar. So that means, that implies that they have a Google Gmail account. And so that's why it's done through there. You can share your calendar for people that don't have a Gmail account, but it is only through a public link, and they basically just get a web page where they can see view only is the only capability that you can actually give them. And that's where you do it on that sharing screen, where you say, make available to public, and then you get a shareable link, and you just give that person a link, and then they can use that to view your calendar. Now, this is something that I don't necessarily recommend. You know, they do come up with a big warning. They don't include the robot. They say, making your calendar public will make all events visible to the world, including via Google search. Are you sure? So, with the realization that it will be visible to the world, you could go ahead and do that. I would suggest most people probably want to really think twice, three times, four times before they actually decide that they will go over and do that. Another thing is if you go into the this is if you say you got permission to access somebody's calendar, but you missed the email where you can say add to calendar. So you don't have to ask them to reshare it or anything like that. You can just go to the other calendars and click on the plus where it says other calendars. And then you just click on subscribe to a calendar. And you enter in the Gmail address that you want to subscribe to. And then, then it will show up in the list. So that's it, I think, for being able to access or share out your calendar to other people. Any questions?
Okay. I think I just saw a comment here from Tom that you can create more calendars and share them via a link. And when you view public calendars, it includes choice of date, event details, colors. You can set alarms, etc.
Yeah, there's one handy thing, too, is the City of Ottawa actually has calendars that you can share or you can subscribe to with garbage collection. And so it'll put it on where you can have it show up on your calendar when garbage and recycle is being picked up and things like that. It's kind of neat.
And if you don't use a calendar, you can also subscribe for a weekly email, which will tell you that tomorrow is the collection day and it will tell you what they're picking up.
That's good stuff, yeah.
And if you rely on the paper calendar, I believe next year they're going to eliminate that. Okay, next up we have a share from Linda.
Okay, thanks, Alan. So I saw this article in McLean's on digital pyramids, and they didn't have a graphic, so I made one. But I found it kind of an interesting subject, so I researched it a little further after I put together this triangle. So you sort of think of the old, I think the Canada's Food Guide had that kind of pyramid as to what you should eat. So it's basically at the bottom is, you know, you can have as much as you want, education and learning in terms of digital consumption, digital learning, and then creativity, art, photography, music, communications with friends and faraway relatives. And this is really important that we get to stay in touch with people, especially relatives who aren't in town. And then above that is participation when you're gaming but with other people. And then at the very top, the least recommended amount of time would be spent doing very passive things like just gaming by yourself or scrolling. Next. So I kind of wanted to investigate what other pyramids were out there. So this one's called the Digital Media Diet. And they actually use the old pictures from the food. And at the bottom, you can see it's collaboration and creation, education and learning at the bottom. And then the middle one I found interesting, self-care and organization. So we do spend a lot of time, you know, looking for answers to our health issues or wanting to see how we can be, you know, healthier or eat better or whatever. And then above that, virtual community gaming. So again, participating with another person, interacting, social media. And then at the very top, isolated gaming. So very similar to the first one. Next. And then this one I think was my favorite because it's the media pyramid. Now, I'm not sure I quite understand the bottom part, but it's basically talking, it's saying books, chats, art, theater. I guess the thumbs up is you can spend as much time as you want on those things. Not so sure I agree with that. But anyway, the next one up, education, hobbies, nonfiction, and journalism. So 3 hours per day. And then above that, 2 hours would be it actually gives you credit for choosing things you want to watch rather than just having them flow at you. You go and you think, I want to watch this on Netflix, so you get credit for that. And it basically says in the notes that we are drawn to junk food of the mind just as we are the body. And so that was kind of interesting. So that's that level. And then above that is your 1 hour of interaction. Interpersonal communication is good. Spam is bad, obviously. Broadcast TV is fine. And then half hour consumption if it's Facebook, X, you know, Instagram, whatever. Heavy social media and rolling news consumption decreases well-being. And then the very top, you shouldn't do any of this at all, and this is basically the false news. People tend to consume media that supports their existing views, but any content where ideology leads to falsehood is bad for you. Okay, so the next one, this is the last one, And so very similar. So this was showing, this is from Atkins Digital, and this was showing navigation, search, music at the bottom, then work and education up to 4 hours, and then less than 2 hours on news, sports, video, shopping, and then less than 1 hour on social media. So I just thought it was kind of interesting, and certainly it's good to keep in mind, and if you have any youngsters in your life, then maybe it'd be interesting to share it with them.
Okay, thank you very much, Linda.
You're welcome.
Next up, I have a couple of questions that came in, and I split them up because they're slightly different, but obviously related. And the first one was, what tools can you use to create a bootable USB drive? And as far as I'm concerned, there are a number of such items. If you want to just write one application to a USB drive, a single installation on that drive, then you can use Rufus, and you can also use Balina Etcher. And I've talked about both of those at various times. However, USB drives these days are really big, so it's kind of a waste to just put one installation on a USB drive. So the obvious thing to do is pick a media creator that will allow multiple installations on the same drive. And the one I've been using is Yumi, and it does exactly that. It allows you to add and subtract all kinds of different installations on a given USB drive. And another one I think somebody else mentioned in the Q&A a while ago is Ventoy, where you basically just load ISO files onto the thing and it runs them from a menu. Those are the ones that I know about and mostly use. If anybody has any additional things which are much better or different or useful, if you want to let us know, we'll follow up on that. The second part of the question was, what tools can you install on a USB drive that you can use to do diagnostics for your computer and operating system? And in particular, were there any tools, any of those kind of tools built in to Windows 10 or Windows 11? And that kind of links up with one of the questions on the survey that we did, where one of the respondents wanted to know how to fix the computer when it stops working. So those are clearly related issues. So there's a number of kind of rescue tools that you can use by creating a bootable USB drive. Hiram's Boot CD was an old program a whole suite of programs actually that was loaded onto a CD. Now somebody has taken that and created a USB version. So if you go to that URL, you can download it and you get all kinds of different rescue tools. It's like the Swiss Army knife of diagnostics and repairs, I guess. Similar type program, a suite of programs again, is called Medicat USB. That's clearly a more modern one and designed instantly for USBs. And then if you're a Linux person, then the Ultimate Boot CD, again, can be installed on a USB, but it will let you diagnose Linux systems and repair Linux systems, as well as, I think, regular Windows too. So those are some of the tools that you can use, one of those burning tools to load onto a bootable USB and then run the various diagnosis and repair tools that are available. And some of the systems that they have there would be things like data recovery. So if you've deleted files from your hard drive, then there are programs that will try to recover that for you. There are various disk partitioning tools. Boot repair, if your Windows system or your Linux system just won't boot, then it's quite likely that it's just the boot sector that needs repairing, and There are tools to do that. There are tools to test memory. There are tools to test spinning hard drives and solid-state drives. Third-party antivirus scanners, and etc., etc. So those are the kind of tools that will be available on those bootable USBs. Turning to Windows 10 and Windows 11, there's a whole rack of them, and here's a list of them. I mean, right at the top there is CheckDisk. That's a really old program, but it's good for doing a scan of a hard drive to find problems with files and folders and that kind of thing. The System File Check, DISM, and then a whole raft of other things, the Task Manager, Performance Monitor, etc., etc. We've talked about some of those in Q&A's past. So those are kind of the common tools between Windows 10 and Windows 11. They both have the same, essentially the same features there. But there are some tools that have some differences, and here's a list of those according to one of the AI chatbots. Windows Memory Diagnostic, improved in Windows 11, it says. Reliability Monitor, again enhanced with Windows 11 specific features. The Troubleshooters, and a PowerShell script, I guess, to get computer information, again expanded for Windows 11. So if you have any kind of issues that you want to diagnose or problems that you want to try and fix, then those are some of the tools that you can try to use to do that.
A couple of comments in the chat. Tom says a recent Windows install USB is also useful. Always good to have around. And Steve Parker says RescueZilla is a very good one as well.
RescueZilla is a backup program, is it not? That's what I use it for. It's a backup and recovery.
Well, it says, it says the Swiss Army knife of system recovery. Yeah, it looks like it is disk imaging. Yeah.
It's got it pretty much has all of the above.
Okay.
I've only ever used it for disk imaging. I thought it was a disk imaging program. Okay, no problem. Swiss Army knife of whatever. Okay, we're a PC user group, but I know a number of people have Apple products and iPads in particular, iPhones especially. So this question came in. Chris and I can't answer it because we don't do Apple, so we don't know about these things. But the question was, the individual has an iPad. It's this particular version of the operating system, 17.7.10. Apple has now stopped support for that particular version. Is it safe to still use, say, Gmail on this iPad? And can you use things like Facebook Messenger? I don't know. When Windows stopped supporting it, I wouldn't be happy doing online stuff with Windows, so I'm not sure about iPad. So if anybody has anybody's an iPad freak, and knows the answer to all of those questions.
Well, didn't they go to version 26 with the Apple?
I have no idea.
iPhone is version 26, and the Apple Watch is 26.
It sounds like this person is saying that the version of the hardware they have is that 17.7.10, and they can't go. It sounds like they can't go to a more recent version.
I think the current iOS version is version 18, not a bunch of things.
Well, it was before they changed it to the year number. Which was at the end of last year.
Last version of the 426.
That's only for recent iPhones and iPads and tablets. If you've got an older one, then you're stuck at previous to that. And
it won't update to the later version?
You can't update anymore. They don't support anything else. They just stop supporting it. That's it.
like a number of other things, if the operating system updates stop, that doesn't mean security patches don't continue for the apps. And
doesn't necessarily mean they continue.
When the app doesn't even run, that's when you can't use it.
Well, yeah, it's a bit of a black hole question, really, because I don't know. I do not like the idea of using an operating system that is not supported by the vendor from a security point of view. And unless you have assurances that 17.7.10 is still supported for security patches,
yes,
then I would be leery about.
Yes, it is.
I have an older iPad.
You're just not updating the device to a newer version of the OS.
Yeah, in which case it would be
safe. It doesn't get updates. It's basically stops. And even the apps, you'll find that some of the apps will no longer update because the apps require a newer version of the OS.
Well, now you're
so essentially what you end up with is a device that maybe you can read your Kobo stuff on, but I wouldn't do a whole lot more with.
Yeah, when you're talking at that point, that's when it's questionable whether
and
you
Natalie,
can go on the internet with it.
Natalie asks in the chat, does it apply to Android versions as well? Yes. I think any operating system on any device, at some point, the vendor is just not going to support any changes to it, including security updates in all likelihood. And at the point where you're no longer getting security updates, then I would be very leery about continuing to use that on the internet.
That's kind of why the CBC ended up using the Amigas as keeping the doors open with.
Yeah.
And I note here it's actually worse for Android than it is for, say, iPhone, because Android has a shorter, or used to have a shorter support period, only like 3 or 4 years. So when your support runs out, you are kind of stuck. However, in terms of Android, Android is an open source operating system, and there's a series of developers who will generate custom ROMs, basically customized version of the Android operating system for specific devices, and then they keep maintaining those with security patches on an ongoing basis, usually for as long as they own that particular device. So it doesn't necessarily last forever, but it can certainly extend the lifetime of your Android phone if, A, you can unlock the bootloader on the phone, which you can for a number of models, and B, you're prepared to go through the hassle of doing the unlocking and actually installing the custom ROM, which is not a trivial task, I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on. Chris has got keyboard shortcut number 4.
Yeah, so in the never-ending quest to make sure that people are using their computers as efficiently as possible, accessing the address bar when you're in a browser. And so frequently, I think most people do end up clicking the mouse into the address bar in the browser, either to type in a new URL, especially if you type in or add a new tab or something like that, or if you wanted to copy the URL to the clipboard to either paste into an email for somebody or something like that. So there's frequently that people will use the mouse and go and click on the address bar. And rather than grabbing the mouse and clicking to get there, I would suggest using Alt-D. And this works in all browsers, and it will just automatically put the cursor up into the address bar. Not only that, it will select the entire text that is there at that point in time. So if you are copying it to a new into an email or something like that, all you have to do is press Control-C to copy it, go to your email, and you can paste it in. And on top of that, bonus, this also works in File Explorer. So it'll go to the address bar in the File Explorer where you can type in a new location, different drive, or whatever. That's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Actually, the next share is yours, too.
Okay. Yeah, this is an article from Paul Thurrott, who's been dealing with and teaching and blogging about Windows for many, many, many years. And he has this article on de-enshittifying Windows 11, specifically OneDrive. And so he talks about what are the problems with using OneDrive, and specifically OneDrive folder backup. How to uninstall it, how to prevent it from enabling it back when you set up a PC, how to reverse changes that OneDrive folder backup will make on your computer, which can be really, really annoying. And there's some other annoyances in there. The last part of it is behind a paywall. You have to subscribe to his channel or whatever it is if you want to be able to get some of these premium articles. But there's an awful lot of information on this one that is available to non-subscribers. So if you are interested in getting rid of OneDrive on your computer, it's not a bad resource.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, we keep asking people, what are your favorite applications for Windows and Linux and even Android? And Natalie submitted a program called AnyBurn, which is clearly a CD burner, CD-DVD burner. She uses it mainly for copying CDs or ripping tracks from a CD to MP3 files. And she was using a discounted version of Nero, but it was just a one-year promotion, and then they wanted real money for it. Clearly, it wasn't the cat's meow, because she was quite happy to go back to AnyBurn, which she's been using for 10 years. And she says it's got a pretty simple interface. It's quick and easy to use. There's a pro version, which you can pay for, but it has limited additional features. And for most people, I should think the free version is probably good enough. You've got two different versions, a classic one where you download and install the program, or there's a portable version which you can use. And some of the features on the website, you can burn CDs, DVDs, and Blu-rays. You can create audio CDs and MP3 CDs from various musical files. I presume that means different file format types. You can rip audio CDs to files. And you can create a bootable USB drive if you download an ISO file. So that's like a bit like Rufus, where you would download an ISO and then create a bootable USB from that. And you can manipulate disk image files for CDs, DVDs, and USB drives. And then for the pro version, you can install Windows to a USB drive. And I think you can do that with a Windows utility. And you can convert music file formats. Well, again, there are different free options to do that kind of thing too. So anyway, if you're interested in a simple, easy to use, free CD burning program, AnyBurn is recommended by Natalie. Okay, next up we have a couple of things from Stuart, who's now going to unmute his microphone and go ahead.
Sure thing, now. So, we are supposed to be a multicultural country and multilingual as well. And Google Translate is the translator that pretty much everybody uses, because pretty much everybody uses Chrome. So there you go. But it's always good to have a couple of language translators handy. Because sometimes it just doesn't make any sense what Google says. So that's when you hit it with a different translator. Now, I use Brave Browser, and it's got its own built-in translator, but sometimes it agrees with Google and still doesn't make sense. So anyway, another one that I came across recently is called Linguist, and this is a Chromium browser extension, so it'll work with any Chromium browser, and it's open source. It's not a Google product, so you have a bit more privacy that way. And it's very simple and easy to use, and seems to work well with every language I've tried, which is French. You can click on the translate button when you load the extension and get the page translated, or you can just highlight a word or a phrase and there will be a little pop-up button that will let you translate that particular word or phrase if you think you already know what the rest of it means and you're just stuck on one item. So you can't have too many translators, I always say.
So Susan is recommending a program called DeepL Translate, which she says is the world's most accurate translator.
Yeah, that's from Germany. I've tried that, and it's pretty good, too.
Okay, so the next one is yours, too, Stu.
Sure thing. This is a sort of a basic level kind of thing, but something that's handy. Offloading and archiving. That's iOS and Android. If you have a bunch of apps and on your mobile device and you don't have enough space for your hundreds of photos of your Big Mac that you took yesterday, you can free up a bit of space by doing one of these things. Now, Android has a process called archiving, and it will automatically delete most of the data from apps that you're not using, but keep the app on your device. So it's not there, but it's there. And you have a lot more space. However, with Android, apparently, you can only auto archive stuff and let the device decide what you're using and what you aren't. So I'm using an Apple device, a couple of them actually, and they call it offloading. And you can auto-offload your apps and let the device pick and choose for you as well. Or you can go into the settings and your storage and then individually drill into each and any app you particularly want to offload for the moment. And basically, this keeps the little icon where it is on your screen, and when you decide you want to use that particular app, you just tap on it, it downloads the software, and all your logins and configurations are still there, and you can continue using it as if it was never offloaded in the first place. This is kind of handy for a few reasons. Obviously, you get more space. And if you've got 15 language translators on your device, well, you don't need them all the time. So you can only keep the one or two you may need the most and offload the rest for emergencies. One other benefit to all this, too, is security. If you're not using an app and you have it sitting on your phone, it's another point of vulnerability that could be attacked, whether it's updated or not. It's another attack vector for malware to look at. But if it's not there, it can't be hacked. So only keep the software on your device that you're using, and you'll have a lot less attack vectors available for bad guys to take advantage of. That's it for me tonight.
A couple of comments, just going back a little bit to translate. We had a recommendation of lingui.com, good for English and French. Question about whether any of these translators can work offline, and DeepL can't. But Tom points out that Pixel devices translators can work offline if you download the language pack for the particular language.
And a couple of other people were saying that DeepL works well for both Japanese and German. So if you have those languages, that's a possibility.
I got interested when I was thinking about the presentation tonight, and I started looking for First Nation language translators. And I can't find any of them, the big ones. But I did find a website that will use AI to translate. And I may talk about that next week, because it looks really weird. I didn't have time to look at it tonight.
Cool. We love weird stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Talking about weird stuff, Chris, the next one's yours.
Yeah, okay. I came across this, and I was kind of surprised because I haven't seen a lot of exposure about this, but Malwarebytes was reporting a security bug in WhatsApp, and it affects specifically WhatsApp on Android. They don't talk about any other platform at all, but it does allow attackers to add you to group chats, which would not necessarily be very nice, or send you malicious files in group chats, and that wouldn't be very nice. So, one of the recommendations is to turn off the auto download of media. So you go into settings, storage and data, and then under the media auto download, make sure that you uncheck all of those things, and then click on OK. And another possibility, they say, is to stop WhatsApp from saving media to your Android gallery, where it could be visible to other apps. And so you go into chats and turn off media visibility for that. And lock down who can add you to groups, because all of this is based on the idea of somebody adding you to some random group that you didn't realize. So you can go into settings, privacy, tap groups, and then change from everyone to my contacts or my contacts except, and then exclude numbers that you do not fully trust. Now, that's a bit of a double-edged sword, of course, because in some cases you might want people to be able to add you to groups, and you don't necessarily know who they are ahead of time. But it was just one of the things that I identified as a possibility to help strengthen things. And that's it.
No, you got one more bullet there.
Oh, do I? Sorry. Oh, yeah. The other thing, and this is just, generic, pretty generic. Set up two-step verification for your WhatsApp account. And that's probably a good advice for any app that you have, any service that you use, and so forth. If you set up two-step verification, that always helps things.
Chris, do you know if that when you're turning off all those things about media, you still can access the media, it just doesn't do it automatically?
Yes, that's right. That's my understanding of it, yes. It's just the auto-download of it so that it won't just automatically get sent to you. If you call for it, I presume that it would still work.
Okay. All right, thanks. Okay, so next up we have another submission on a useful program, and this time it's from Jeff Dubois, who's going to tell us about his experiences with Color Helper.
Well, yellow, everybody. Color, see? We're already starting with colorful puns. I'm red-green colorblind, red-green color deficient. So color, actually telling what color is the right color, has always been an impossibility for me. About 8% of males are red-green deficient, and somewhere around 1%, I believe, of the females. So this affects quite a few people. So what I was actually looking for was some sort of utility or extension which I could use my mouse to hover over it so it would name the color and it would appear as a like a tooltip would in your SysTray, like if you hover over the Windows Security, Windows Defender, it'll say Windows Security active, no threats detected or some no action required, something like that. So I was hoping to find something like that, something simple. We can, next slide, I guess.
Yeah, the next slide's all your good old days slide.
Oh, yes, back in the good old days. It took a while to pop up on my screen here. I had no idea. The thing is with colorblindness, you don't know that you're colorblind, because how can you know what you don't know? And it wasn't until I was in grade four, I think it was grade four, that I found out that I was colorblind. We a geography class, we were given some maps, and we have to color them and submit them in, and is the savannah the right and the water? Well, I guess my grasslands were brown and my water was purple. So when the assignments were handed back, mine didn't have a grade on it, which I thought was kind of odd. But I did get a note from Mr. Jameson saying, the nurse wants to see you. Of course, the teacher knew right away, okay, we got another colorblind kid. He'd seen it. I didn't know. Now, you're what are you, maybe nine years old, I guess, about nine. And down you go to the nurse's office, and you know as a nine-year-old the smell of alcohol. You know when you go in that room, she's probably going to harvest your organs. You know that. It was terrifying, simply terrifying. But she presents me with a bunch of charts with blotches on them. And what do you see here? It's like, well, it's an umbrella. It looks like an umbrella. Well, actually, I think it was probably everybody else in the world would have saw a 4 or 63 or something. But colorblind people will see something entirely different, sort of like those psychological tests they would give the Section 8 guys in the Army. What do you see here? Anyway, so she informs me that I'm colorblind, and she gives me a pack of Laurentian coloring crayons that had names of the colors on them. So the red actually said red, and my problem was solved. Okay, so that was a helpful thing. I could know the colors. So what I was looking for was a tool that would easily do that. I went on Perplexity. I went on ChatGPT, and I was, oh boy, it gave me, I read, get it, read? I read pages of different recommendations on all of these different browser extensions I could use, and I blew through all kinds of them. There's another nice color joke there. Finally, I came upon this color helper, which was a very simple extension. So that's what I settled on. It's just a simple little extension that you can install. We can go to the next slide there, Alan. So basically, I went to the Q&A page because everybody would be familiar with that. And you'll see these notes on when they post their notice on Facebook for the OPCUG or on the Q&A page. This is the note, our next meeting, the little post-it note. Now, to a colorblind person, what color is that? It seems obvious to me that the note is most likely yellow. I don't get that wrong very often. But what color is that push pin? That's a tough one. anybody not colorblind, they would know. I used to ask Nancy, by the way, what color is this? On the screen, and she'd say, that's taupe. I go, what the hell is taupe? It's not a color. It's not a real color. Or it's opalescent. She would say it's opalescent. I think she was doing it on purpose. So finally I said, okay, I've got to get a tool. So there we go. So color helper to the rescue. Next slide, please. So you install the extension. You simply click on it. And there's a couple of selections. You can check once you click on it to activate it. Yeah, you can click on selection, and that'll let you select an area much like the snipping tool, or you can just click on the viewport, and then you can move your mouse anywhere on the screen. Next slide. So this is what happens. You move your mouse to over the push pin to find out what color. And my surprise was, wow, it's not green. It was actually red. So then you know what color is on the screen. Now, I know for anybody who might be listening to this tonight, you're going to be green with envy that you've come across this new tool that'll help you out. And all I'm going to say is, aren't you glad I told you about it?
We might not invite you back. Okay, thank you very much, Jeff. Actually, that's a really useful tool. I sometimes like to find out exactly what color is a certain thing on an image, so I can maybe use the same color for the text in a PowerPoint slide. So, you know, the RGB or the hex codes are quite useful in that respect. So you could even non-colorblind people could make use of this particular tool.
Well, it's ideal for some desktop publishing, that's for sure. I've often needed the hex addresses too. But I was really hoping for something that just said blue or yellow, but I couldn't find something quite that simple. If anybody knows of something, I'd love to know.
Well, this one says red in the top left-hand corner there.
Yeah, no, I just like something that popped up with a quick tool tip. Part of the other reason is I can hit one key and call the speech program on my screen. So if I just tap the hotkey for that and hover over it, if it was just a tool tip, it'd just speak the color out loud and I wouldn't have to, you know, struggle to look for that, which would be really nice.
Right. Well, if anybody has a better mousetrap, then let us know and we'll pass it along to Jeff. I'm talking about mice.
Yes. I have two things about mice, and they're sort of related. So one of them is just in a computer basics on adjusting mouse speed. So if you have your mouse speed too fast, if you have just the slightest movement, you can end up with the mouse cursor jumping way beyond where you actually wanted it to go to. And so it can be really hard to get the mouse to exactly where you wanted. On the other hand, if you have it set to too slow, you try to move long distances and you move your mouse over to the edge of the desk and then you have to pick it up, move it over, drop it down again, slide it again, and so forth. And you might have to do that multiple times in order to get where you want it to go to. So in order to change that, if you go to settings, which the easiest way to get that is the handy mnemonic of Windows I, because I is the fourth letter in settings. And then you go to Bluetooth and devices, mouse pointer speed, and you'll have a slider. And you can just drag it back and forth. There's no OK button. It takes effect immediately. And so you can see what the effect is and adjust it further if you need to. So that's computer basics on how to change the speed of your mouse. Now, how this came about for me in particular, when a scroll wheel dies. So I had a Lenovo M300 mouse, and the scroll wheel stopped functioning. Everything else was working perfectly fine, but I use that mouse wheel all the time. And so I navigate web pages, documents, and so forth using the scroll wheel rather than going over to the elevator scroll thing. So in well under an hour, I decided, okay, that's it. I got to get a new scroll wheel right away, because this is just too annoying. And so an important requirement for the mouse for me was a button on the mouse that would allow you to adjust the pointer speed rather than going through the menus. So sometimes I need really high precision. So I use Snagit as a screen capture program, and it allows you to do pixel-level precision on what gets captured. And so you can see an enlarged area that you're going to be capturing, and then but you have to then click the mouse. And I found that if your mouse speed is too high, just pressing down on the mouse button, it would move the mouse a little bit. And so I would end up with less precise than I wanted in terms of what was going to be captured. So knowing that, I could go and go to settings, Bluetooth, devices, mouse pointer speed, and decrease the speed, and then do my screen capture, and then go back and set it back to what I normally use. That's kind of a pain to use it. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just easily switch the sensitivity only while you're working in that high precision work? And that's what the DPI button on a lot of mice will actually do. So if you have that little extra button on a mouse, it's almost certainly a DPI button. And so on the Lenovo, it would allow you to cycle through up to three different speeds that were available. And there was a utility that came with the mouse that allowed you to control those. And so you could define up to three, and you could set it to any DPI. And so the DPIs are, you know, 1 inch of movement of it on the desk would give you a certain number of pixels across on the screen. And, of course, there are limits on the top and low values, but you could actually do that so that each time you hit the DPI button, it would cycle through those three different speeds on the mouse. So I started looking around online, and I didn't find that they actually detailed much about the button on the top. And I wondered whether it was always used to adjust speed or if it had other uses. Gaming mice seem to always have it, but there was a lot of non-gaming mice that also have the button. And I decided, well, I'd rather just talk to somebody. So I actually went into local Best Buy, and the staff person was actually very knowledgeable about it. And he said that, yes, all mice that have such a button, it is configurable for DPI settings. And different mice may have different speed ranges available, as well as different increments that you can actually do. And talked about a lot of the different brands and so forth, and the Razer brand mice seem to be coming up as high quality, highly configurable, and good mice. So I eventually settled on the Razer Cobra 8500 DPI gaming mouse, and if I have it set at the maximum speed of 8500 DPI with a 4K monitor, in less than half an inch movement of the mouse, it'll actually traverse the entire screen, which is like really, really speedy. The minimum speed is 200 DPI, and you have to move the mouse 19 inches to actually traverse a 3840 pixel screen 4K monitor. So that would allow for really, really precise positioning, and in my case, where I was doing screen captures, it wouldn't move the mouse when I clicked on the mouse button. So very precise positioning and so forth. I don't find that is really all that useful. It's actually too slow, but all the buttons are configurable on the mouse. There's color lighting effects that come into it because it's a gaming mouse. It has glide pads on the bottom that are PTFE, which is a very low-friction plastic, so very smooth movement on it. $45, which was a little bit more than I would normally spend on a mouse. But all buttons configurable. So on the screen, you see there's two side buttons as well as the two normal buttons and the scroll wheel and the DPI buttons. And you can configure all of these to include modifiers as well. So you could do shift and click or, you know, shift and scroll the wheel and have it defined to whatever function you wanted. So it can be keyboard functions that are done. You can actually have it to do mouse functions. So you click on any of the buttons and it'll be either, you know, a click, scroll left, right, up, down, everything like that. You can have it speed adjusted on any of those buttons. You could actually do it. You can actually have macros tied to any of those buttons so that it'll do a multi-step mouse option, operation or keyboard functions. Or you could have it launch a program or website. And you also can define them for multimedia controls. So any of those buttons, you can have it do volume up, down, so forth for media playback. So the way I configured the DPI button on mine, I enabled 3 of 5 possible levels. I didn't find I needed to go through 5 different levels. I enabled it at 200 DPI, 1800 DPI, and 3200 DPI. I normally operate at 1800 DPI, and I'm thinking of actually configuring the 200 to something more like 400 to 600, because I don't really need it as precise as you get with the 200. I configured the side buttons. Button number 5, I configured to be a sensitivity clutch, which is kind of neat, because rather than using the DPI button on the top and cycling through 3 levels, what I can actually set it to is so that while I hold down that button, it automatically sets it to 200 DPI while I'm holding it, and then it flips back to whatever I was at previously when I release that button. So I find that kind of handy. And then on the button 4, I configured that to do a shift control escape, which will run Task Manager, which I'm in very frequently. So I rarely paid $45 for a mouse. I'm pretty cheap. You can get mice as cheap as $5. I think most people should avoid $5 mice, but a realistic starting point is $15. You can get actually a pretty decent mouse for around the $15 mark. So the Razer Cobra, I think it feels really solid. It's good. They are known for very, very good sensors, optical switches, and so forth. It had the critical features that I wanted, very configurable, so I can configure those side buttons to do special things for me. And for me, it was worth $45. So that's it.
Did you take a look at any of the mice that use absolute coordinates instead of relative?
Nope.
You said they're on like Wacom tablets.
Yeah, well, I use tablets, and I have a Cintiq display as well. Actually, when I was using a Wacom tablet, I did use absolute positioning with the pen, but I never used a mouse on that surface or anything like that.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. If anybody's looking for a mouse and has lots of money, they can buy one of those.
Yeah.
Okay, I came across this YouTube video, which isn't a YouTube video, it's an article in PC Magazine on, he calls it Prompt Engineering 101. And it's basically a whole bunch of information about how you should write prompts for AI chatbots that will give you good results. So it's basically that idea that Bob Harris keeps telling us about. Give it lots of information, and it will generally come up with a more reasonable answer. And so if you want to know how to write good AI prompts, then this article is quite a good starting point. And you'll want to know that because you'll want to be doing some vibe coding. And I have an article in the current newsletter about the basics of vibe coding. It's basically what I was talking about a couple of weeks ago, just in an article format. And it also runs into the fact that we would like to run a competition. And the competition is going to be for the best application that somebody can produce, or alternatively, the best presentation of how they actually proceeded with the development of the app. And it can be a successful completion, or it can just be a sob story about how badly things went with your AI experience and you didn't read the Engineering Prompts 101 article. So we'll have more about this later on. You've got lots of time. We can't run the competition until this fall. So take a look at the article, take a look at the past Q&A sessions, and think about what you could do with vibe coding. We're already past last 10 minutes, so I'm just going to keep going with the wrap-up. Chris mentioned if you're not a member of the club, we have a special offer right now. If you are a member, then you don't need to do anything because the board of directors will extend your membership by another year at absolutely no charge. So please don't send us any money because you don't need to pay to renew. But if you're not a member, if you give us $20 right now, before March 31st of 2026 would be a good idea, not 2023, before March 31st of this year, and you actually get 1 year that you paid for, and we will give you a second year absolutely free. So 2 years membership for the price of one. Upcoming presentations at the library. Chris is doing his World Backup presentation tomorrow night in Manatic at 6 o'clock. Fun with Fonts at Blackburn Hamlet on Saturday at 2 o'clock. And if you want to go to Ireland and Scotland without moving out of your chair, no, you can't do that. You have to, without moving out of the library chair at St. Laurent Branch at 6 o'clock on Monday evening, Linda's got her armchair travel series. And a bonus presentation, which is coming up, armchair travel in British Columbia. This will be a Zoom-based session It's on March the 3rd. This particular one is at 7 o'clock, note the time, it's not 7:30. And there's the URL, and that's, I think, in the newsletter, certainly on the website, and it will be in the deck, which I'll post later on to the website. So,
if I could just say, Ellen, that when I was reading that slide, if you could go back to the BC one. So when I say the summer from the 1920s, I don't mean the birds, I mean the photos.
Those are the same kind of birds. Okay. All right, so next item on our agenda is next Wednesday, which will be March the 4th. It will be our next Q&A session. We've gone through a bunch of the stuff that we had on tap, so if you have questions that you'd like answers to, if you have follow-ups on some of the questions that we've answered tonight, we've asked tonight, but you have the actual answer, or if you've got topics that you'd like to share, just like Linda and Stuart and Jeff did tonight, thank you all. Please send us just a note on what you'd like to present or what you need to know, and we'll be adding those to the agenda for next Wednesday, March the 4th. So we'll see you then. Hope everybody enjoyed it tonight, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, all. And, yeah, we did have the three people that were presenting tonight that much thanks for your participation at that level. But we also had people who just sent in questions and follow-ups and things like that. So great participation, and keep it coming, folks.